What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
It has been 682 days since October 7th, 2023. In today's casualties update, the Palestinian Health Ministry says 60 people have been murdered and 324 injured by Israel in the past 24 hours, which brings the death toll to 62,004, with another 156,230 injured in this time. That does not include deaths by starvation, which as of this morning totals 263 people, including 112 children. We know from research elsewhere that the death toll is likely closer to 80,000, and even that is perhaps an undercount. Here on Law and Disorder, we've spent the majority of the Mondays of the last almost 2 years bringing you Palestine Post, where we push back on the Israeli and U.S. mainstream media campaign of disinformation in its attempt to justify a genocide. We begin today's Palestine Post with headlines analysis with Dr. Usama Makdisi, a professor of history and chancellor's chair at the University of California, Berkeley. He was previously professor of history and the first holder of the Arab American Educational Foundation Chair of Arab Studies at Rice University in Houston. He's author of many books, including Age of Coexistence, The Ecumenical Frame, and The Making of the Modern Arab World, which was published in 2019 by the University of California Press. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. I haven't done this in a minute, but I used to with my first guest, and I want to now, especially because we have added in, and I actually think the first time we chatted was when we were first getting the starvation count numbers, but I want to give you an opportunity, a pathway. Your reaction to this morning's numbers?
I mean, it's shocking. It's absolutely shocking. Here we are in 2025, and there's a deliberate genocidal Israeli campaign to starve Palestinian civilians and children to force them ultimately to leave Gaza, to ethnically cleanse Gaza. That is the plan. The Israelis have been explicit about it. It's absolutely shocking. It's unconscionable. It's depraved. It's actually sickening. I don't know what else any person with an ethical sensibility or conscience could possibly say about this situation.
But actually, I'm gonna jump a couple of questions because that gets me to wanting to talk about, you know, Egypt and Qatar, who are still talking about a ceasefire, who are still talking about a two-state solution, who are condemning the dire conditions. Egypt saying that it's ready to flood Gaza with aid as soon as Israel lifts the ban, but they're not using their military force to press the issue, right?
Well, yes, but they don't actually have... I mean, remember that both Egypt and Qatar are in the U.S. orbit, and the U.S. orbit is very clearly pro-Israel in the sense that it's deeply anti-Palestinian and the sense that it's deeply pro-Israel. This is the U.S. official orbit. And Egypt has, in a sense, acknowledged and accepted Israeli hegemony. And so that's why they can say a few words here and there, but on the ground, they've done nothing. But in fact, in many instances, they've been complicit in the suffering and the torment of the Palestinians in Gaza.
If I'm remembering correctly, in an interview I did maybe almost over a year ago with Phyllis Bennis, before Egypt really tightened its borders and some Palestinians were able to get through, the refugee camps set up there were just as bad as what the folks that were stuck in Gaza were experiencing, yes?
Well, it's not just that. It's that there's that official Egyptian, I mean, or semi-official, I don't remember if it's official or semi-official Egyptian authorities were actually fleecing Palestinians. Remember, they were asking for $5,000 to $10,000 per person to leave Gaza, to get them out of Gaza. It was hyper-exploitation of people who were enduring the most unimaginable form of oppression. And then to add insult to injury, to be asked to give up basically tens of thousands of dollars or to get family members to give up this money to get people out. I mean, it's sickening on so many different levels.
Why perform at all? Why tap dance at all? Why doesn't Egypt just say we're in the U.S. orbit and it is what it is?
Because the Egyptian government understands perfectly well that at a popular level in Egypt and across the Arab region and across the world, in fact, there is genuine outrage and genuine horror at what Israel is doing to the Palestinians. So it's not that most Egyptians want to see Palestinians suffer. It's not even, I think, that the Egyptian government necessarily wants Palestinians to suffer. It's that they are all subordinate. All these Arab states are subordinate to U.S. Interests in the region. And U.S. interests have very clearly said explicitly in the Biden administration, as well as in the Trump administration, that they don't care one bit about Palestinian life. What they care about is Israeli prerogatives. And that's where we are.
Professor McDC, I want to tug on the thread a little bit more to serve my own ignorance. Can you say a bit more, perhaps, about maybe the economic ways in which Egypt is in the U.S. orbit? Like, what are the consequences? If Egypt were to buck, I'm not saying they have any interest in bucking, but if they were to buck, what then could potential consequences for them be?
Well, I mean, remember that Egypt in 1978 signed the Camp David Accords, and then 1979 signed the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. And that peace treaty essentially abandoned the Palestinians to their fate under Israeli occupation in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, and of course in the Gaza Strip. And as a result of that treaty, the U.S. flooded the Egyptian government with money, basically the Egyptian military, I should say, with the second highest foreign military aid package after, of course, the highest aid package, which goes to Israel, which, of course, is much smaller than Egypt. But the Egyptian military became dependent upon the U.S. And in turn, the bargain was that the Egyptian state would no longer confront Israel militarily and turn a blind eye, in effect, to what the Israelis were doing to the Palestinians. That was one of the consequences of the much celebrated in the West Camp David Accords, which basically allowed Israel, as I said, to continue to colonize historic Palestine at the expense of the Palestinians, in return for Israel giving up parts of the Sinai, or giving up the Sinai Peninsula, but on condition that the Sinai Peninsula remains demilitarized largely, while Israel, of course, maintained its massive military on its side of the border. So the consequence of Egypt signing a peace deal with Israel was essentially to allow Israel to do what it was going to do to the Palestinians. That was what the Egyptian state signed up for, and it became dependent militarily on the United States.
Thank you for that. I'm going to turn back to the conditions in Gaza right now. We've watched over the last, I don't know, a month or two, every morning we wake up. I mean, one of the first things I do is log on to Al Jazeera to see the murder count since dawn. And every morning it's been a horrific number. Well, we've all known Israel's intention, right, this whole time. They have not explicitly said, right, that they're going to take over Gaza, and they're going to do it by bombing Palestinians.
But more bombing.
Continuing to bomb. What happens now without foreign intervention, and where are the people to go? I mean, I know the answer to that question, but you're the guest.
I mean, it's honestly shocking to say the Palestinians have been completely abandoned. They are on their own. It's true, the Yemenis and for a while some Lebanese and others were trying to help bring attention to their cause. And people around the world, of course, have mobilized endlessly, including you, of course, as you've been saying for the past 2 years. People have been speaking out endlessly about this depravity of what is going on in Gaza, this genocide unfolding before our eyes in 2025. There's very little the Palestinians can do at one level, because they are besieged, they are being starved, they are being brutalized, they are being sort of persecuted. There is a genocide taking place against them. On the other hand, the question for the Israelis is ultimately, and then what? So the Israelis have spent 2 years pulverizing Gaza. They have spent 2 years devastating humanity in Gaza, obliterating the entire landscape, and they still don't control all of Gaza. So what exactly is the end game? It's not other than wishing that the Palestinians just simply go away and disappear. Other than that, what is the end game here?
What do you think the end game is?
I think there's a fantasy, a deeply entrenched fantasy, that somehow the Israelis think that through massive, extraordinary, extreme, unconscionable depravity, that somehow the Palestinians are going to go away. The Palestinians are not going to go away. Yes, the Israelis have killed and they've murdered and they've massacred and they've done the most unconscionable and horrific things that the entire world has seen. And yet, that doesn't solve the question of Palestine, nor the fact that the Palestinians are the indigenous population who will remain tied to their lands.
I just want to make a note, and you can respond or not to this. I just want my listeners to understand that all of this that we're talking about is happening as temperatures reach scorching levels, which is exacerbating the dehydration that comes along with starvation, causing skin diseases to spread. And not only has Israel banned food and water in terms of aid, less talked about is Israel's ban on aid that would be utilized to build structures that could provide shelter, including tents.
Yeah, it's a deliberate, I mean, Kat, it is a deliberate campaign of dehumanization and making life impossible for Palestinians in the most cruel and deliberate. That's the point that for all your listeners to remember is that this is all deliberate. This is all calculated by the state of Israel, by the Israeli officials and by the Israeli military. This is all calculated to inflict extraordinary pain and suffering on Palestinians, including, of course, on Palestinian children. This is what everyone who supports this kind of project should remember. This is what's happening on the ground to millions of people.
Speaking of dehumanizing, I'm going to bring our attention over here to the United States, where right-wing conservative pundit Laura Loomer, due to her social media campaign, has influenced the State Department to halt all visitor visas to people from Gaza, including humanitarian medical visas for injured children. What does this mean materially for these folks, and particularly young people? And what does that say to you about the depravity of the U.S. government? We've been talking about Israel's.
Well, yeah. I mean, we know there's a linkage, obviously, between the two depravities. They're in the end, what Laura Loomer and others who are so cruel in their sort of visceral anti-Palestinian, anti-immigrant racism. It's so shocking. We're talking about Palestinian children who have been mostly sort of tormented by U.S.-made bombs dropped by Israel, thanks to U.S. aid. And the idea that a few Palestinian children who are in the United States receiving medical treatment because of a genocide that has been inflicted on them by the United States, by Israel, backed by the United States, the idea that these children pose any kind of threat to the U.S. is obscene. It's actually obscene. But, you know, we know that the rhetoric and of the right wing is obscene in general.
Doctors, just tugging on this head a little bit more, doctors have that makes it all the more egregious. Doctors have attested to evidence that the Israeli military is deliberately targeting children in Gaza. 40,000 killed or injured in the war, according to UNICEF. And earlier this year, UNICEF said that the Gaza Strip had the highest number of child amputees per capita anywhere in the world.
I mean, it's not just that, Kat. I mean, it's been 2 years. We don't need any more. The evidence has been there before our eyes for 2 years. I mean, every hospital, like the hospital is destroyed, every university destroyed. There have been countless UN reports. Francesca Albanese, all these UN special rapporteurs on human rights, they have documented this time and again. Israeli human rights organizations have documented this, what's going on in Gaza. None of this is hidden. This is all absolutely explicit. The number of journalists killed, the number of teachers killed, the number of doctors killed, the number of children killed. It's shocking at every level. And the fact that there are still people in this country who turn a blind eye to this, or who say, who in fact support this, is so shocking to me.
Man, I guess I wonder, and I'm pretty jaded, so I don't often try to look at the opposition and figure out what makes them tick. I do wonder if for some folks, if it's so egregious that they can't wrap their brains around it.
Yeah, because it's sort of like Macbeth. I mean, it's sort of the idea of, you know, it is, because it is going to be shocking, especially when the dust is settled. And then you'll see how many people will try to say, oh, no, we were always opposed to this genocide. We were always shocked. When you know perfectly well, there have been so many people who have been silent, so many people who have been complicit. And of course, not everyone who's silent is complicit, because there are a lot of people who are just, there are a lot of people who are stunned, who are shocked, who are immobilized, who are depressed, who are appalled, but who don't necessarily speak out. But there are so many more who do speak out, who do and should be speaking out and don't.
To your point around, we have all the evidence we need, right? We have all the numbers. I mean, I think about that every Monday as I'm preparing for Palestine Post. Like, how many more times do I talk about a report? How many more times do I read the numbers? You know, we talk about it here. We talk about the black condition in the United States. Like, we don't need another study of what's happening to black folks here.
Exactly.
What is the role, from your perspective, those of us that have platforms, what should we be talking about?
Well, I mean, exactly what you're talking about. Remember, Kat, that what's happening now is you know, if I step back from the emotional sort of, the appalling emotional sort of reality, and the human reality that we're witnessing in Gaza, this kind of, this depravity caused by Israel, backed by the United States officially, we have to also remember that there is a huge, massive generational shift that has been taking place, a global shift of opinion taking place. Remember that the vast majority of the world think, in a sense, like you and like me. In other words, they're horrified by what is happening in Gaza. The vast majority of the world, I would say even most Americans, frankly, are appalled by what is happening in Gaza. And I think, I'm sure the vast majority of people in this country do not want a genocide to unfold in Gaza. They're opposed. And that shift is taking place. And at the same time, you have those forces that are so deeply anti-Palestinian. They are so deeply anti-freedom, anti-equality, anti-Palestinian in essence. Those forces ultimately still have a lot of power, but they've lost the public relations and the public opinion battle. And that's important to remember. It doesn't end the genocide. It doesn't give us any succor or any it doesn't help us when we think about what's going on in Gaza. But in the longer term, I think it's important.
Professor, I want to be respectful of your time. Thank you so much for joining this morning. We will have you back again.
Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.